Failed you. Welcome to the Village Oak Tree for September 18th, 2024. I'm your host, Terrence O'Donnell, and I thank you for joining me once again this week. I wish to welcome retired Major Robert Cook, an author, and today we're going to talk about his books and some of the things that he's done, and I'm just going to roll through and find out what he's all about and ask a few questions. So with that, oops, we lost him. All right. Yes, sir.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning, or afternoon, or wherever you are in your time zone. So I typically kind of let you introduce yourself. Tell everybody, you know, who you are, what you've been doing, and what you're all about.
Okay, I'm sort of a retired entrepreneur in the software business. I've written four books, all in the same theme with the same character set. I call them geopolitical national security thrillers. And I'm about promoting this last book, The Mahdi.
Yeah, I saw that. And I wanted to ask you about that. I saw your book, and I saw the other ones too, and I thought those look really interesting, because those kinds of books, you know, I like to read. So tell us a little bit about how they got started and what they're about.
Well, the first one was a book called Cooch, and it started sort of out of the blue. I was back to Vietnam on a cruise, and we got into a typhoon. Everybody on the ship was sick except me, so I wrote a book. And it went okay. And then one of the things that I did in that his father had a Medal of Honor in a wheelchair that he got with the Medal of Honor. And so he was, went to the Marine Corps at 16 and was picked up to the CIA Special Ops at 18 and spent a lot of time there. So all the boom, boom, bang, bang happened there. The book was about druggies in the U.S.
Okay.
Second book was about Yemen. And now you're getting into the Islamic side of it.
Mm-hmm.
And a plot to put a gas attack in Dallas Stadium. Third book was a U.S. preemptive attack on Iran, which happened.
Yeah.
The first introduction of an EMP, electromagnetic pulse.
Okay.
Which was a key enabler in this fourth book, The Mahdi.
Okay. Well, that sounds pretty good. I mean, you know, there's been some other authors like that in the past, you know, where I've read their stuff, and some of it was okay, some of it not so okay, far as it goes. But you know, I myself did five tours in the Middle East, so I'm real familiar with most of the geopolitics and things like that over there. And of course, it's been 20 years since I played in the sandbox, but still, I keep an eye on things, even though I'm not playing over there anymore.
It's been 45 for me, different sandbox.
Oh, yeah. I know what you mean. So, I mean, think about it, though. Based on what you know from your, you know, from when you started going over there, and then, you know, my last deployment was Afghanistan in 2002. You know, tell us, what do you think about the history and everything that's going on over there?
Well, I'm on record with this book, The Mahdi, as saying there's a solution, but it's a religious solution. It's not a political solution.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is my protagonist gets involved in the West Bank, trying to get some of these proclaimants out of the Israeli government that if you're not Jewish, you can't hold property in Israel. That's just not rule of law. It's not good, and that's how I got involved.
Yeah.
It seemed like a good novel to me, so I began to do the research, and it was a good novel for me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wrote it, and the plot is he goes over to get a conversation going on the confiscation of the West Bank Bedouin lands by the Israeli government, which goes on today.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets thrown into prison. And so the plot thickens from there.
Yeah. Sounds
well, he's in prison. He recruits a bunch of Palestinian prisoners to be his helpers.
Mm-hmm.
And he decides to fight a very limited action with the M29, the successor to the 40 millimeter grenade launcher that we knew.
Right, right.
And he designs a new round for it and gets into a tussle with one of the only right bank portion of the Israeli government. So that's how it all started.
Okay. Yeah, I'm going to have to order that book, because it sounds, the more you talk about it, the more it sounds pretty good.
It's a good book.
Yeah. All right. So, I mean, I'm kind of a history buff. And so I've been, you know, last few years, I've been reading about all the stuff that's been going on the last 100 years over that area, starting with the Balfour Agreement, you know, in 1917, and then kind of what happened in World War II, the Nakba, the first Nakba in 1948, and, you know, and all everything that happened after that. So, I mean, what do you think about all that?
Well, I think that the whole thing was a cluster, because British didn't own anything. They divided up with the Balfour Agreement.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get to 48 and you still didn't own anything. You divided it again. And the Israelis decided now, I guess, that they want all of it for themselves. And that wasn't what the agreement said. And what we're facing is Israel going into a theocracy. Mm-hmm. And that won't be a good thing. The rule of law will be upset. And there were a lot of demonstrations until this kerfuffle in October of 23.
Right.
That was ugly.
Yeah. I mean, there's been a lot of ugliness through the years, various kind, mostly inflicted on the Palestinians, far as that goes. But, you know, the worst thing is, you know, I spent a lot of time over in the Middle East, as I said, but my last trip over, I was actually embedded, not wearing a uniform, wearing local clothing, no dog tags, nothing, just running around special operations unit. And so I learned a lot more about their culture over there than I ever learned on any of my other previous deployments. I didn't have big army around me at all. And it turned me around quite a bit as far as the way I looked at things. And so I've been looking at a different angle ever since. But the big thing is, here in the United States, Islam in itself is vilified every which way but loose. And I'm like, why, you know, why can't you figure out that, you know, there's all these Muslims in the United States right now. Why can't you learn to get along with them? I mean, I don't understand I kind of understand why mainstream media is doing it. They're doing it for the money. But I mean, what do you think?
Well, there are 3.5 million Muslim Americans, and they're being dissed and ignored and so on.
Right.
And I think that the Israeli lobby is very strong in the U.S., and that makes the Palestinians and the Muslims bad guys, and they're not. I think there's a way to work this out that's in everybody's interest. But the first step is not turning Israel into theocracy. It's right. Talking about the problems and getting them done.
Yeah, and I agree. I mean, I'm kind of watching things here on this side of the ocean as well, because the Islamic population in this country is really kind of setting themselves aside here more than they used to, especially with these factions called uncommitted groups and various other ones running around right now. They're building up quite a head of steam. So I'm kind of curious to see how that's going to work out here between now and November. But I'll be watching that. But again, you know, you're not going to get much out of the mainstream press about any of that stuff. You know,
well, that's true.
Yeah. I mean, they want what they want, and for them, it's all about the money. I mean, that's one of the things that I learned when I was in Afghanistan. We had a group of reporters from the United States embedded with us for about a month while we were over there. And I was there 10 months, almost 11 months. And they flat out told me that, mainstream media in the United States is being told by the government what they can write, what they can't write, what's going to be published, what's not going to be published. And I thought to myself, well, what happened to freedom of speech? He said, now, this one guy from New York Times told me, yeah, that went out the window a long time ago. He said, you can forget about that. And I'm like, wow, okay.
Yeah, I didn't know that. That's not good news.
No. I mean, this was 2002. And then, of course, I had that when I came back to the States. And in 2003, I watched George W. Bush tell the Washington Post, you can't publish certain things because if you don't, we're going to sanction you, put you out of business, basically. And the Washington Post basically shut up, and that was the end of that. And then, a few other things. And it's been ramping up ever since. And now, I mean, if you watch the news right now, if in any part, which I watch indie news, I don't pay any attention to any of the American mainstream, but they're all saying the same thing, is that freedom of the press basically is all about the money. If you don't toe them, if you don't toe the federal line, basically what we're going to allow you to do, we're going to put you out of business. Now, the independents pretty much operate, they get their money from like Qatar and other countries. So they're not worried about American sanctions too much yet, although some of them have been, pushed around a little bit. But for the most part, they're being left alone. But the ones here in the United States, yeah, they're getting hurt.
Well, Fox is on one side.
Yeah.
Everybody else on the other side.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I discount Fox. They're being paid for straight up. They're not trying to hide it. Murdoch and company pretty much tells them everything they need to do. But the other ones like CBS, ABC, NBC, CNN, all the rest of them, though, and like New York Times, Washington Post, they're scared to death the American government. And their editors are only allowing certain articles to go through that they know that the government's not going to come down on them. And I've read multiple news stories from independent news saying this. And I'm like, that's a big deal here in this country. And
I don't know that I agree that the government's telling them what to say in every case.
No.
But I think the mainstream media is so progressive, so left-wing oriented, and they're behind the progressive program. So they're not too hard to convince what to write, what not to write.
No, this is true. I mean, for them, it's all about the money. They're going to go where the money is. And the money, as you say, is more about in the left. I'm not going either right or left. In my case, I don't advocate one way or the other. But I do see a serious trend right now with this big push for the Democrats, for example, with everything that's going on. Then the other side, you've got a lot of what I call the right side on news media. And they're, so that's one of the reasons why everything's going neck and neck right now. The Democrats, right now are pulling ahead somewhat, but as everybody's saying, and even in this morning's news, they're still not, Trump and Harris are still running neck and neck for the most part. So it's,
well, they're shooting at Trump again.
Yeah. Well, I'm not surprised. He's an easy target.
That's surprising. Well, yeah, exactly. Maybe he is.
Yeah. I mean, he's out on a golf course,
Yeah, you would think the Secret Service could cover that, but
you think?
To be fair, I think the perimeter that's funded for candidates is a lot narrower, smaller than that for the president or the vice president.
Yes. Well, the other difference is Kamala Harris is still a vice president, so her security detail is probably going to be a little bit better than Trump's. Because it goes back to what you just said. He's only a candidate. He's not an actual official. He's just a candidate. Right. So he's going to have slightly less than. And he obviously is not going to pay for his own private security. You know, he would never do that. You know, he's only going to take what the government in, you know, and he'll complain about what he's got. But meanwhile, though, of course, they're going to eat this up like it's, you know, cannon fodder. But it'll be interesting to see how this works out. Because I noticed that I read something this morning about this kid that they caught. He's just another nut job. Now, the first one in Butler, Pennsylvania, there's a lot of speculation about where that kid came from. But this one at the golf course, you know, he was just another nutcase. But, it goes back to what you were just saying. The fact that he got through and got close enough to actually, you know, do something. He got within a visual of Donald Trump, apparently. That tells you something about the security detail. They're not where they should be.
Well, maybe they're not funded out that far. There's a concentric circle around him.
Right.
And his is smaller than the one around the president and the vice president.
Right, right. Yeah, so he's got a big bullseye on him. I wonder if he understands that.
You know, in my book, I put the president pretty neutral in the Israeli-Palestinian thing. You know, he's not neutral today. Biden's definitely heavy down on Israel. Right. But in the book, the difference is a fusible EMP round, which can blow up electricity anywhere.
Right.
And overwhelming communications. And the advantage that the Israelis have is in combined ops. Mm-hmm. And you require good communication for combined ops.
Right.
And they're the best.
Yep.
But in my book, it gets compromised. So it's easier to defeat a country of 6 million people the size of New Jersey if they don't have any communication.
That's right.
That's what went on.
So, you know, it's funny. It's funny you talk about that because, you know, I was in the military during the Cold War days. I mean, I joined up right after right at the tail end of the Vietnam War, and went through, you know, active duty with the Cold War stuff. So, I say that only because that's one of the things that they taught us back then was all about nuclear warheads and EMPs and all that stuff. And I've said all along, you know, don't rely on technology for so much, because an EMP or a couple of EMPs could pretty much take out everything that we have. I mean, the internet, you could lose the internet, and, you know, basic communications, you know, you're down to doing line of sight walkie talkies if EMPs start going off.
Well, yeah, if they don't go, they don't fry the walkie talkie.
Right.
But the thing about it is I this is fiction, of course. Mm-hmm. In Pulse, which was when the U.S. launched a preemptive attack on Iran, they were riding Tomahawks with an EMP. Mm-hmm. Well, Boeing proved that. I saw that in a press release a while back. So I could use that. Mm-hmm. And in the latest book, The Mahdi, I've got it reduced so that you can shoot it or make a little hand bomb out of it and throw it on a power station. That power station's fried forever.
Yeah, yeah.
So I reduced the size, and the effect is the same.
Well, you know, be honest with you, as advanced as the Chinese technology is, and, you know, they're not talking about it, it wouldn't surprise me a bit that might be a real thing now.
Well, I think you're right about that. What's interesting is that the nature of warfare is changing.
Yes.
Right now. The drones, unmanned vehicles, unmanned ground vehicles are all going to make a big difference.
Yep.
If you're not going to have to go rescue a pilot, you take a lot more risk with an aircraft.
That's right.
If it's unmanned. And I think there's an existential threat to Israel and what's going on now. They think they can take over all of Israel and defeat the people around them. And that's not a slam dunk.
No, especially with Hezbollah being the way they are these days. And, another one I read this morning, Hezbollah is saying in the news over there that they are prepared to defend themselves against Israel. They know that they're going to take a lot of casualties, but they're prepared for it because they know that they're going to inflict a lot of casualties in Israel as well. So
and Israel's not prepared for that.
No, they aren't. They aren't. And, you know, the worst part is Israel is really depending on the United States to fill in, and Israel doesn't get it. The United States is not going to do boots on the ground for them over there.
Well, there won't be boots on the ground.
No.
Otherwise, it'd be a revolution here.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. See, so Israel, you know, is still on the mindset. And I'm quoting, paraphrasing a bunch of other independent journalists who are all saying the same thing, that despite what the United States is doing to back up Israel, it's strictly defense only. So in other words, Hezbollah starts throwing rockets, drones, and everything else over there. Yeah, the United States and Jordan and all that, they're going to step in and do what they can to knock out as many as they possibly can. But no matter what, Hezbollah's got enough stuff over there to throw at them that no matter what, the Iron Dome is not going to work, okay? A bunch of it's going to get through. And they know, Hezbollah knows this. But Israel apparently is still thinking that no matter what, you know, I'm like, all right, you know what? I've said this before. The American military system that we have right now, our military structure is not what it used to be, okay? We don't have the soldiers that we used to have. The quality of our equipment is not what it used to be, you know, compared to the new stuff that's coming out. So all we can do over there to defend Israel, so to speak, but ultimately with the new stuff that's coming on the market right now, between what Hezbollah has, you know, for a fact that if they get into a shooting war, that the Yemenis are going to jump in, they're going to be firing from Yemen. Iran is just going to be feeding the supply train. So either way, Israel, there's no way, even with the American help, Israel's not going to stand up. They won't.
Well, they may, but you know, if they do, it's not for long.
Right.
One of the points I make in the book is they're in Thucydides' trap, where their advantage is all technology,
mm-hmm.
but the technology gap is narrowing.
Right.
As the world gets better, I mean, Iran's getting closer to a nuclear weapon.
Mm-hmm.
All those kinds of things. So if they don't lose it today, they'll lose it in the next 10 years, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I don't know why they take that risk.
Yeah. I don't. Well, as far as why they're taking that risk, you can see the government over there in Israel. They're a bunch of lunatics. I mean, they don't get it.
Yeah, who is?
Well, yeah, him and Smotrich and them other guys. I mean, they're fanatics, unfortunately. And I don't know. I really don't know how that's going to work out. I mean, depending on what they do, I can figure out what they're going to, you know, how it's going to work out. If they stand down, you know, who knows? I feel bad for the West Bank and the Palestinians in Gaza, far as that goes. But the rest of it, you know, hard to say.
Well, I think that the Palestinians, both in the West Bank and in Gaza, are in deep yogurt right now, and it's not going to get a lot better.
No.
But I proposed in the book that Israel works with Saudi Arabia and the United States to create the technology, engineering, and educational facilities with our money
mm-hmm.
that can bring the Middle East up to world standards. That would be a major contribution to world peace, I think.
It would. Yeah, just getting people on board with that. That's the big thing. You know, that's kind of part of this. I've been watching a lot of stuff about this new BRICS alliance, and that's kind of the direction they're sort of kind of heading. And they, you know, it's kind of a rocky boat still. I'm kind of like, yeah, all right. I'm willing to watch it, see how it pans out. Meanwhile, I'm looking at how the United States and its Western allies are posturing about this. And I'm thinking to myself, well, how's that going to work out? You know, the G7 bloc is all upset because the BRICS is starting to get bigger. They're worried about their, you know, their economics and stuff. I'm like, you know, folks, why can't you all learn to get along? You know?
Well, exactly. You know, the BRICS thing, October 22nd, there's a meeting in Russia.
Yeah.
And we'll see what happens after that, because if they do a currency transaction with the price of gold linked to a unit of some kind of BRICS, it's going to really hurt the dollar.
Oh, yeah.
Dollar's still a reserve currency, but it's going to do damage.
Yep. Yep. And that's the one thing that, you know, that's the other thing that I look at too, is I watch a lot of independent economic journalists, if you will, podcasters, and they're all saying the same thing right now. The United States is headed into another recession, and it's going to be really bad by this time next year. So I'm like, okay, you know, it's kind of interesting to watch out. Now you take that and you add on to that, this, you know, what's going to happen in October over in Kazan, Russia, with the big meeting over there. So now what? And so, yeah, if they, if the BRICS comes up with some kind of new so-called cryptocurrency they're talking about, that they can start trading using their own, you know, everybody else's funds, like Indian rupees and Russian rubles and who owns in, you know, Chinese yuan and all that. Yeah, you're right. Next year, United States could be a hurting unit.
Yeah, it'll be ugly.
It'll be ugly. I
don't want to see boots on the ground in Iran while that's going on.
Yeah, no, 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 no. You know, I think the United States in some ways is smart enough to know what would happen if we put boots on the ground, you know, the ground over there. So I don't think that's going to happen. And it's like I was reading something the other day that, you know, ever since Afghanistan and Iraq, mostly Iraq, you know, 20 some years ago, they relied on air power to, you know, drop lots and lots and lots of bombs on people. And that's what the United States would attempt to do this time if they decided to go after Iran. The only problem is, ever since, you know, this little tit and tat they had a couple months ago, Russia has been feeding advanced air defense systems in Iran through the back door. And you have to know that Washington knows about it. So that might be something that they're thinking about. Like, yeah, we might be able to send a whole bunch of planes over there, but how many of them are going to get shot down?
And, well, there's the issue of Iran is getting a lot of experience at attacking U.S.-based weapon systems in Russia,
yep. Yep.
So they can modify their drones.
Yep.
So they can send over armed drones and right down the radar pulse to the Iron Dome.
Yep.
It could get very ugly.
It could. And you have to know that the Pentagon, you know, and sometimes the guys running the Pentagon are, you know, they're as dumb as a box of rocks. But other times, they're not, you know, they're smart. You know what I mean? They're smart in some ways, and they just don't say anything. And this is one of the things that I learned, even though I was just an NCO. My biggest thing was the suits run everything, okay? I don't care how many stars you got on your shoulders. The suits are still going to run things.
Well, that's the way the system works.
That's the way the system's supposed to work, you know, in theory, but there's supposed to be a balance. But here, you know, the last 30 years or so, that balance has been knocked off. The generals have some control over things, but I found out, especially when I went to Afghanistan, that the guys from the State Department, they kind of rule a roost. At least that's what they told me anyway.
Well, you know, as far as being dumb as a box of rocks, I haven't found any dumb flag officers. The selection criteria is so rigid.
Yeah.
They get rid of the dumb guys when they're majors.
Yeah. Yeah, there's some truth to that.
I mean, the rest of them are pretty smart.
Right, right.
And we spend a lot of money sending them to school,
right,
to graduate school and so on, so they stay smart.
Right, right. And you're right. I don't need to disparage all these generals. They didn't get to where they are with, you know, by being totally stupid. And I have known some captains and majors that I think should have gone back to school, but that's a whole nother story. But, you know, the big thing is what I fault, I guess, is the system that we have to a degree that puts the thumb on these guys who would would be able to keep soldiers out of harm's way without, you know, compromising too much of the United States. I mean, the idea of us, our ability to defend ourselves, I mean, that's first and foremost, okay? But, you know, sticking our nose in other people's business just because somebody at the State Department has a specific interest, or you got senators like Lindsey Graham and Tom Cotton who want to bomb everything just because, like, okay, you know what? You guys, you're not in the military anymore. Stand down, okay? Lindsey Graham was never in the military. You don't even know what it means to be over there. So
never saw a bomb go off.
Yeah. You know, I'm sorry. You never had anybody shoot at you with an AK-47. So you need to just sit down and go home. But you know, Tom Cotton, he did his time in the military, but yet you'd think with his, you know, military experience, he'd know better, but apparently he didn't get the memo.
Well, you know, they're arguing now about globalization and all of this is part and parcel of globalization. Mm-hmm. And Trump said, no. Let's look out for our own.
Yeah.
And so that's going to be the big issue, I think, in this election.
True. I think that's going to make a big difference because there are a lot of people in the United States who are all about kind of reining things in, bringing everything closer to home. And I think that's one of the biggest divides is that you've got a lot of folks who are living hand to mouth, paycheck to paycheck, and they want to change. They want their lives to get better. And they don't see a government right now that's helping them very much. And they see these people running around in expensive suits, making a lot of noise, but ultimately, they're not helping them. So they want something different. And
suits are not helping.
Yeah. And then you got the other half who live in a high income tax brackets who are all about keeping things the way they are. They like their lifestyles. They want a government that's going to keep it for them. So, you know, you got an even divide between what I call the haves and the have nots. And that's one of the reasons why I think that everything is running neck and neck right now.
Well, you know, history says the haves can't go much farther than the haves have in this country. Or there's a revolution, there's kinetic resistance. We don't want kinetic resistance.
No, we don't. You know, and that's another thing I'm a little concerned about, too. I had a phone call last week asking me, you know, am I geared up to work on November 5th? And I'm like, well, yeah, I mean, I'm ready to go. I'm, you know, I work for the county polling system here. So I work the elections every time they have one. But they asked me, you know, if I was ready to go. I said, oh, yeah, sure. So I was joking with the lady. I said, you know, do I need to bring my Kevlar and my body armor? She said, well, no, we don't think it'll be that bad. I said, well, yeah. Okay. Yeah. But I'm thinking, well, you know, since my job is to, you know, is to get everything going and stand outside and, making sure everything's okay before people get in, I thought, well, you know what? I'm standing outside. I got a bullseye on my chest. You know, maybe I ought to put a little padding on.
Yeah, but that only stuff a handgun anyhow.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, that's the thing, too. So I don't know. They told me I don't have to worry about it. I'm like, yeah, right. You haven't met some of these people. I have.
Well, yeah, too many.
Yeah. Yeah. And I say that only because I've been working there for a couple of years now. So I went through the local Republican primaries last year, and there were about three or four. I mean, I work for a small polling station, and so we don't get that many compared to other places. But still, given the percentage of voters that did show up, there was a good percentage of those folks who were out there in the parking lot doing some kind of crazy stuff. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, you know, how many more of these are going to show up in November?
Right. And a lot.
Yeah. And that's what worries me. That's what worries me. I mean, I'm not too worried about myself.
Faith. I have an abiding faith in the American people. At the end of the day, they'll do what's right.
Yeah. You know, and you're right. And yes, with you, as far as policies is concerned, I don't really see our foreign policy changing that much, although Trump says he's going to shut down the Ukraine war, you know, as soon as he gets in office, maybe even before January. And I'm like, okay, I wonder what that's going to look like. But at the same time, I think it would be a good thing. But then
if he shuts it down, yeah.
You know, if he can get it done, I'm all about it. But at the same time, I'm looking at his other side and like, he doesn't care what Israel does. He's just going to let him go. I'm like, well, all right, that's not a good thing. So,
you only let it go until one side starts winning big.
Yeah.
And then you have to decide what to do.
Right. Well, you know, the question is, what would he do? You know, nobody really knows for sure. He hasn't really said for sure. So there's a big question mark on that one.
Yeah, my idea in the Mahdi was to have Saudi Arabia, United States, and Israel each pitching a third to rebuild what's been destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
And then have Israel lead the way in technology, but not in politics,
right,
to a new Middle East. Because the politics is going to be Islam. There's 2 billion Muslims and 6 million Jews in Israel.
That's right. That's right. And that's just
in a country the size of New Jersey.
Yeah. You know, and I agree with you. They're severely outnumbered. Now, if the Shias and Sunnis, which they are starting to now, but it's always been a question up until recently whether they could get along and make something happen. But that's starting to happen now. They're starting to come together on this and saying, hey, we're going to put aside our differences and we want something going on here.
Yeah, one of the things I mentioned in the book is that the protagonist is an Islamic scholar.
Mm.
You know, when you write fiction, you can do anything you want.
Yeah.
And
he
says that the schism between the Shia and the Sunni is an apostasy in the eyes of Allah.
Mm.
And I think it would be right. And that's what they're bringing around now.
Yeah, yeah.
Bring them together.
Right, right. And, you know, it's no different than in a lot of the stuff that here in this country. I mean, we got a lot of people that have different opinions that work together. They seem to be able to work things out. You know, it's just a...
Nobody gets everything they want.
No, you know, and that's what people got to realize. You got to figure out a way to come together in the middle and, you know, be happy with what you can get. We could just get some of those people in Washington to realize that things might be a little better. Unfortunately,
they certainly would be.
Yeah. I mean, this whole business of Vance and company talking about people eating cats and stuff in Springfield or whatever it was, Ohio, I think it was. It's like, seriously, you're going that way? I mean, come on.
Well, you know, and you've seen and I've seen people eating dogs and
if they
really were hanging up a cat and stripping us, that's the way you eat a mammal.
Right. You know, I did some time in Korea, so I know all about that.
Oh, that dog's a delicacy. Yeah.
That's right. But of course, you know, you can't tell a lot of Americans that. And I'm like, I used to make a joke. I don't do it anymore because people get upset. But years ago, I mean, when I was a little more aggressive, I would make jokes about people's pets. You know, you're walking down the sidewalk with your fuzzy looking Pomeranian. And, you know, I'd make a smirk, you know, a smarky remark and say, yeah, that looks like lunch. And
right.
Somebody would look at me like, what? I'm like, yeah.
What kind of sicko are you?
Yeah. Yeah.
You go to Korea and the guy would say, yeah, it does. Come to think of it.
Well, you know, years ago, I was in Korea and we were out running around. It was pouring down rain. We were looking for some place to eat. We stopped by this little mom and pop Korean restaurant. And, you know, our Korean was pretty minimal and their English was pretty minimal. So we just said, hey, you know, we want to eat lunch. And we were probably a squad and a half level, 6 or 8 of us. And we sat down at this, you know, they put some tables together for us. We sat down and we said, well, you know, let's get a chicken. Well, I don't think they understood the word chicken because they brought out this really, really big chicken, put it in the middle of the table, and it didn't quite taste like chicken. But you know what? We were hungry. We didn't ask.
That's a good thing. Don't ask.
Yep. It tasted good. We didn't care. You know. And then later on, we kind of like, was that chicken? Well, who cares? Right? Yeah. You know, but again, it goes back to, you know, me looking at Pomeranians saying, yeah, lunch.
Exactly. Well, read my book. I think you like it because there's a lot of stuff in there that we've talked about.
Right.
And right now, as a result, I think Israel's taking an existential risk they don't have to take by biting up more than they can chew against a pretty well-armed Iran and all these proxies.
Well, you know, everything I've been reading and a lot of it, one of the news organizations that I listen to is called The Gray Zone, and they publish a lot of stuff. You know, I'm also, you know, reading a lot of stuff now from another one just recently, but they're all saying the same thing, that the fanatics in Israel don't really care because they think that the United States is going to give them whatever they want. And if they get in real trouble, the United States is going to, you know, unload a bunch of amphibious Marines or, you know, drop a bunch of 82nd Airborne guys out of the sky at them and back them up. I'm like, well, no.
No, I don't think so.
I don't think so either. Yeah. Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen.
They'll unload a bunch of ordnance if we have any left.
Well, but there's that too. This
a different issue.
That's a whole nother issue. Yeah, most of our ordnance has been going to Ukraine here lately. But so I think as far as the rest of it goes, that's kind of all I had to talk about, really, was kind of your take on things, which is kind of like the same things that I'm talking about. And I will...
That either makes you smart or dumb.
Well, I try not to go either way with that one.
Yeah.
The big thing is it's all about who you talk to. I try to stay away from people who, you know, are really far right, far left, and don't want to listen to anything. You know, I try to stay center left, center right, depending on the topic, and kind of keep everything in the middle and go from there. I always like to get other people's point of view, as long as you're not a radical. I stay away from those people. I don't want somebody foaming at the mouth and screaming at me. You know, that never goes over very well. As far as that goes. But, you know, I do find, for the most part, former military have a better head on our shoulders when it comes to things like this. You may have an opinion one side or the other, but it's not a fanatical one, you know, and I'm okay with that. As long as you're not.
Yeah, but a lot of people have never seen a poor person, so they think they're poor. We've seen poor people.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I tell people all the time, I did 8 deployments overseas to a lot of different countries. I've seen poor. Okay. I've seen some of the worst you could imagine, and these people managed to do just fine. And I've got pictures of Afghanistan from while I was there. You know, I say that only because I had to sneak them out. I was not supposed to be taking pictures, but I snuck a roll of little box cameras, the 110s I snuck in. Somebody snuck one into one of my care packages that made it past the sensors. And I managed to sneak it out with me when the exfiled out of the country and return home. So I managed to sneak out a roll of a film of where we were at. And, you know, you could see poor, okay, you know, right from the get-go. But, you know, the worst thing is, as in the West, we don't understand that, okay? The poorest people in the United States have no candle on the poorest people in Afghanistan.
That's right.
And not just Afghanistan, but Iraq and, you know, anywhere else over there.
Vietnam.
Oh, yeah.
Poor in Vietnam are poor.
Absolutely. I mean, I never got to see that so much, far as that goes, but I did see other countries in my travels, and I did get out into the hinterlands and, you know, Bedouins with camels living in tents, and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, and the thing what people don't understand is that these people, they know that there's better out there, but for the most part, as long as you leave them alone, they're okay. They've been doing it, you know, life for generations, and they're okay with, you know, being the way it is. They're okay with taking a handout Oh, absolutely. But they're okay with not getting it either.
Yep. So you're right. You know, just have to put it in perspective.
Yeah, it is. Unfortunately, you know, and I've done a lot of traveling here in North America, both Canada and the United States, and the majority of the people in both these countries, they don't get it. Okay. Yeah, they see the poor of their countries, both Canada and they look at Mexico and see the poor people of Mexico and realize, well, no, I don't want to be anything like that. And I agree, you know, I've been to Mexico too, and you know, the poor down there are a lot poorer than the ones in the United States. If you want to see an example of that, go to El Paso. Okay. Watch, you can look right over the fence and you can see them, and go to Brownsville, or, you know, even further out. But either way, I mean, that's just how it is. But at the same time, Americans look at those places and look down their nose at them. And I'm realizing, you know what? There might be a time coming very soon, if things don't straighten out pretty soon, you're going to be just like them. And I try to tell people that if you're not careful, you're going to be just like those people, and you're not going to.
Well, I don't know if that'll happen, but you know, we're on our way in the Middle East to ugliness, and I read about it, and you read about it, and you've been there. I've never served there, so it'll be interesting. Read my book; I think you'll like it.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're right. So
the body.
Yeah. I'm gonna tell people about it. I might even throw a picture and let everybody know that it's available. So if you got any parting words for everybody here, whatever you want to impart here to the audience, I'll let you run with it.
Well, I mean, it's worth reading. What I wrote is the solution to the problems in the Middle East without all the kinetic warfare. I finished that book in September of 2023. October 7th of 2023 is when the Hamas carnage happened. Mm-hmm. And it's no looking back since then, but there's no way that what's going on is a better solution than I pose in my book, The Mahdi. So that's what I have to say.
Okay. Well, like I said, I'll try to do everything I can to tell everybody it's out there and get people to go out there and get it from you.
I appreciate that.
Okay. Well, sir,
it's been fun talking to you.
It's been fun. It is. It's been interesting. I'm going to let you go, and I appreciate you coming on the show today.
Appreciate it. I'm happy to do it. Take
right,
care.
Sir.
Have a good
Take
day.
Take care now. Bye. So that was an interesting conversation with Mr. Robert Cook. Former Army major, as he said, he's never served in the Middle East because that was before his time, but he's done a lot of research with his books. So I strongly recommend anybody who's listening to this, go out and find his book called Mahdi by Robert Cook. And be honest with you, I'm going to do it now that I've got a good interest in it, and find out what their solution is. So with that, I'll talk to you again next week. Sláinte. I want to thank you for joining me for the interview again. And as part of that, let me tell you some more about the book. So as I said, as part of the interview, we talked about my guest's latest book, Mahdi. And as he said, and it's a must read if you want to understand the Palestinian situation. So I recommend everybody take a look at it, as I will be doing. I'm going to be hunting it up on Amazon and see if I can pull it in and read it. And I'm a big supporter. I've always been pro-Palestinian since forever. You know, my 5 tours in the Middle East, not only pro-Palestinian, but I supported the Afghans and the Afghanis and everyone else. So let's try and understand what's going on over there and try to do all we can to stop the genocide and the ethnic cleansing. So with that, let me show you this book. And please reach out and find this book. He's got 3 others that he wrote before this. But if nothing else, read this one. And let's come together and see if we can stop the genocide. Thank you for watching. While I still have your attention, I want to tell you about how you can support this podcast and my efforts in general. This podcast will continue to remain free to subscribe to on all the major mobile podcast apps, on my YouTube channel, Krana Biha, and for the first 30 days on my Substack page, Krana Biha, the Tree of Life at Substack.com. With that in mind, I'm asking for donations of any amount. I decided that I would rather ask for donations instead of charging subscriptions, so everyone has an opportunity to watch or listen to this podcast everywhere in the world. All I'm asking for is help in defraying the cost to produce and distribute this podcast and maintain my website. I have set up a donation tab on the Village Oak Tree webpage at rss.com and a donation page on my website at www.crownofbeyond.com, which are all linked to PayPal for your security. This way you can use any currency you wish from around the world, providing PayPal is available to you. Any amount's appreciated. Now, about my website. The easiest way to find it is to copy it from the background behind me if you're watching this video. If you're listening to an audio version, copy the website name from the podcast logo shown. Search for it and enjoy your visit. Lastly, I'm trying to sell some copies of my book, Fugitives in the New United States, which can be found at major book retailers around the world, such as Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and Lulu. You can also buy from me direct through the bookstore page on my website. Fugitives in the New United States is available in hardcover, paperback, and digital form. Free if you're a Kindle subscriber. It's written for young adults and older, so it's safe. If this were a movie, it'd be rated PG. Look for Fugitives in the New United States at your favorite book retailer and enjoy it. If I sell enough, I'll find the time to write the second book in this series. So I want to thank you for your support, even if it's just a like and a subscribe on my social media accounts. Thank you for listening to the show today. I hope you enjoyed it and you'll return again for another episode of the Village Oak Tree. Please like, subscribe, and reply on the YouTube videos or the audio podcast where that's available. This helps with spreading the word about what I'm trying to do, like so many others, which is to shout about all the bad things our governments are doing to us all over the world. If enough of us decide that we don't want to take it anymore, we can force the governments to do right by us as we elected them to do. As I say goodbye this week, I wish to leave you with this Irish blessing as you go about your day. May your hand always be stretched out in friendship and never in want. Slán go fóill.